My talk is both report and charter. I should hope it to be a brief report of what profoundly has been going on in that vast corpus of men and women called the laity around the world, and also a suggested charter as to what must continue to take place in our thinking and lives if we as Christians are to be humbly faithful to Jesus Christ in the world in the day in which he's called us to live. And to do this, I'd like to make three general statements about what I think has been going on and must continue to go on. And in more personal fashion, I'd like to come down to what I would like to have the subject of my brief address, Worldly Holiness, a Lay Imperative. These three general introductory statements, the first one would be this, that there has been going on and must continue to be going on among men and women who make up the kingdom of God in this world, a rediscovery of the world in which we live. Not too many months ago, in one of our very popular news magazines, there came a very interesting story of a GI who was posted overseas. He was a sentry along a dusty road, and each day he would notice the peasants as they came to and fro from the village. One day he noticed a very simple procession coming along. A man on top of a donkey, his feet trudging down underneath in the dust. They were long enough and the donkey was short enough. And about 20 paces behind, a woman, obviously his wife, was walking. The GI, with typical American viewpoint of life, was a bit discouraged, disgruntled, and stopped this scene. He asked the man, "What's what? How come you're riding and she's walking 20 paces behind?" In broken English, in two simple words, came the answer: national custom. By strange coincidence, some 6 months later, the identical scene took place. Along came this pageant as the GI stood sentry. But there was one small difference he was quick to note. Instead of the woman being 20 paces behind, she was 20 paces ahead. He immediately stopped the scene and once again said, "What's up? What's what? I thought you said it was a national custom." Once again, two words, brief, in broken English: landmines. The droll humor of this story also includes far-reaching implications. Implications that in 6 brief months, a custom which was embedded for centuries in a people, that made a difference about the way people walk and move up a familiar road, the way they live and ordinarily habitate their lives, in 6 brief months, suddenly a very simple, sane, familiar road became a place of danger, of fear, of uncertainty, of maybe one's personal destruction. This simple story is a stark symbol of the world in which we live. A world which I'm not sure that I could describe, but if I were to try and use one word, I believe I'd use the word changing, the changing world of the 20th century. But even this is pale and pallid. It needs more. I think the adjective revolutionary would help, a revolutionary changing world. But then you've got to change the word world, because in the last decade, it doesn't even carry meaning. You've got to say it's a revolutionary, changing planet. So I think in rediscovering this world, I'd like to just sketch a few things that remind and recall the world in which we live. The perils and the possibilities that are before us. The good and the evil that face each and every one of us. There are many dimensions from which you could look at this. I'd like to select just a few frontiers. One is the frontier of technological upheaval. The scientific discoveries have mounted in rapid crescendo. They've changed the entire face of our globe, and we operate our human lives to a drastic extent differently than we used to. Some of you know this far better than I in the last 25 or 30 years. If you would just take time when you go home to walk about your hometown and see the fantastic differences that have taken place there. Notice the differences within your own home and within your own operation of life. But I'd like this morning a little bit to have a more global outlook. The vast new realms of power for good or for evil of just one country, the Soviet Union, are staggering to the mind and almost impossible to comprehend. In just their fourth decade, according to President Truman in September 1949, the Soviet Union joined the exclusive atomic club because it let off its own bomb. 10 years later, there have come, in 1953, the H-bomb, in 1957, the intercontinental ballistic missile, 2 months later, in the same year, Sputnik 1, and to greet Nikita Sergeyevich Khrushchev when he came to our country, They'd also done what has been described as putting a very thin bullet through the eye of a needle about a mile or two away. They'd placed a rocket on the moon. We have more or less the same power, though some people say we're something behind. But the question is not will we use it rightly or will they use it rightly, but will man corporately together use it? Will he use this newfound energy, which is equivalent to that of the sun, in a magnificent harnessing for new developments in life and power? Or will he turn the world into his own holocaust, which would be like the sun falling into our world and in the twinkling of an eye destroying it into mere ashes? Will we use the power of the new rocket and the new missile to launch man into interplanetary exploration with all the staggering viewpoints and discoveries and marvels that this has? Or will we rather use it to launch a rocket from some moving base underneath the water that cannot be stopped until it's leveled deadly upon land and destroys the world in which we live? I just mention another point. The development of automation. Not just military power, but automation. This has the possibilities of good and evil, the possibilities of introducing men into all types of fantastic material possessions, even at the pain sometimes of putting people out of jobs, in the hopes perhaps in the future of creating better jobs. There's also the fact that it can give men so much of material good that they come to love material things, and what you love, you become like. And more, man loses his meaning as he becomes nothing but an object, nothing but another thing. Also, the developments in biology. The very fact that medical health now has raised the life expectancy so that in the last 30 years it's 100% beyond what it used to be, and even more so in the underdeveloped countries of the world. This also has the perils and possibilities of good and of evil. Because now people can live longer, can face healthy lives, long lives, and so we're faced with something perhaps more terrible than the atomic and hydrogen bomb explosion. And that is the population explosion, which seems like it will cover the face of the earth, and we can't even feed men because we keep them alive, but all they do is starve. But this biological revolution has taken place not only in medicine, which keeps men alive, but it's also taken place in the way of food. I understand that in the last 10 years, 4.5 million people have had to leave the farms and go to industries in this country because it takes just so few farmers now to feed us all. I understand also that in the next 10 years or even less, 6.5 million more should do this because of the abilities that lie there rampant right within the hands of the farmer. Now, and all of this ability to feed, yet we have surpluses. Because although we can take care of the new population, yet to do so would break down the world of trade and the economic structures of so many countries. I'm just very briefly trying to picture you all the perils and the possibilities and the problems of the frontier of technological upheaval which faces us. I'd like to bring another perspective. The perils and possibilities of the rise of new nationalisms. In the last 15 years, 700 million rather, have gained their independence. 1946, the Philippines, 1947, India and Pakistan, 1948, Burma and Ceylon, 1949, Indonesia, and so on, and so on, and so on. And even now in Africa, Ghana has come forward, Nigeria is to come forward soon, and also all the rest are making pressure to come forward. This too has its perils and its possibilities. Tremendous perils, because although we're so grateful that people now have their own freedom, their own way to judge their lives, yet we also know some of the dangers inherent in what has taken place in Cuba and can take place in other countries. There's not only the fact of these nations rising as nationalisms, but it's not just in the underdeveloped countries of the world. Russia has changed her face to where it's no longer the Soviet Union with internationalism, but once again it's Holy Russia, Mother Russia, with a particular point of view concerned mostly about Russia. France has risen with its grandeur. And America recently has attempted to put out the slogan, Buy America, Buy Only America. All of these things are signs of good and of evil. It's a sign of good that European economy has recovered enough to where it's now a threat and a peril to ours because this is something that we have done. And so we see that you do good and evil comes of it, and some do evil and good comes of it. It's a fantastically complex and peculiar and changing revolutionary planet in which we live. Another dimension from which we could look is racial tensions, the Arab and the Jew situation in Israel and in the Arabic world, or the black and white situation, because of all these hundreds of millions of people in nearly every instance, it's a black or a colored man who's coming from underneath white domination.
And so the two things mix and merge together. And one of the reasons they can come up is because of the scientific and technological and economic change which has taken place. And so all three of these factors merge and mingle together to present the world in which you and I are called as Christians to live. Now, these are some of the frontiers. Now, may I suggest that there's another dimension in which you can look at this world. And that is the great rises of responses to somehow face these answers that we are, that these problems, that try and bring answers to these problems which face us. One of them is the tremendous rise of new religions, and we Christians must concern ourselves with this. The Muslims have grown because they promised to the world universal brotherhood. There's no race breakdown in the Muslim belief. And so in Africa particularly, there's a tremendous surge of the Muslims. The Hindus rise in a fantastic way because they promise universal tolerance in a world that so desperately needs not hatred but tolerance. Buddhists have arisen because they promise to the world universal peace in a world which is broken because it needs peace. Now, this isn't just way over there. This is right here at home. In 1959, there were 7,000 Muslims converted in the United States of America, which makes 80,000 in our own country, or as many as there are Protestant Christians on the island of Taiwan or Formosa, an island which has had Christian missionaries for over a century, and an island whose Christian population has recently been almost trebled because of the many refugees from Red China. At present, in the United States of America, there are as many Buddhists as there are Christians on the island of Ceylon, just south of India, with some 30 million people. And these are the rising religions to try and cope with the problems and perplexities of the world. And then you could give these secular motifs, which also have a religious connotation. When nationalism becomes an end in itself as a religion, when scientism, the ability to use science and technology, becomes an end, and then communism as one of those fearful forces to try and understand the world in which we live and to direct its path and course. Once again, I say, one of the things that has been taking place and must continue to take place is a rediscovery of the world in which we live, its perils and its possibilities as a revolutionary changing planet. And that brings me to the second point of general statement, and that is this, that because of all this, the body of Christ, or the church, we have also had to come and take a new look at ourselves and to see what is our place and what is our purpose in this world in which God calls us to live. The church no longer can be seen as a club where men gather together in congeniality. The church can no longer be seen as a place, some building just sitting on a corner, because this is irrelevant totally to the world in which we live. But instead, we get a new picture, a picture of a corporate body of Christ operating in the world. Can I give you a picture of a battlefield, which seems to be more accurate? You've got a big battlefield with good traveling against evil, and the whole thing, we could say good of the church is trying to penetrate on evil, which represents the world. But on the other side, I do want to completely support the idea that the secular is good. So this is perhaps a bad picture. But yet this is one picture that's emerging, that the church is like on a battlefield facing against the world. And in this all is also the rediscovery of the role of the laity. Now, all I'm trying to do is paint a brief picture. I'm getting down to my point in just a minute, which will be a little bit more concrete. But this is essential, that the role of the laity can be understood relevant in the world in which we live. One of the great moves to understand the meaning and the role of the church is to understand the role of the laity. Now, this is what theology of the laity is all about. It's different from theology for the laity. Theology for the laity is to give men, laymen, a lot of information about God, about the nature of man, about the nature of sin and salvation. All of this extremely important in itself. But there is even a prior concern, and that is theology of the laity, or to try and understand what is the role and responsibility and function of the layman in the world today as a Christian. In a very practical sense, it is, what is my purpose and what is your purpose? What are we called of God to be because we're laymen, because we're Christians? This is what a theology of the laity is all about. And when we begin to see this, I believe that the picture which we have of the world as a battlefield in which the church is good, is fighting against evil or sin in the world, begins to take on more meaning. Because instead of you getting the idea of all the laymen back here on the back lines, bringing in the food and the supplies and the money and the organization power for the evangelists and the preachers fighting on the front lines to bring men over into the church, you get a different picture. But this is one of the dangers which I think is inherent and perhaps also inherent in this lay institute. That the picture now is that these laymen no longer are on the back line, but they're also on the front line. And so we move the whole crew up to get a bigger force up there to fight against the world and to bring the world into the church. But I do believe there is a distinction between the layman and the clergyman. And that this picture is false because it has a wrong picture of salvation, that you pick a man out of the world and bring him into an ark and safely sail him across the troubled waters of the world. The picture more truly, it seems to me, as we really discover the role and the place of the layman, is that the clergyman is in the back lines in a real sense, as the teacher, as the equipper, as the planner, as the maker of ministers of the gospel, men who live in the world. And it is the layman who is the point of contact with the world where the world is. This is the picture which we must come to have possess us and hold us. And that brings me perhaps to three words. We are to be salt. Because the world needs salt that is leaven. Laymen can be salt because they live in the world. We're to be light because the world is darkness. And we're to be life. I heard not long ago that perhaps the most graphic picture of the world today is the group of swine coming down the mountain, the Gadarene swine, which happened when the Gadarene man was freed of the evil spirits. And the swine went plunging down toward the abyss of the sea. One man said this is exactly like the world, plunging headlong to its own death, with two comments: keep moving and keep together. Keep moving and keep together. But we're to be life to a world which plunges towards its own death. And now on a personal note about worldly holiness, a lay imperative. What really are you and I supposed to be as laymen? I think that Jesus puts it this way, when he says we're to be in the world but not of the world. I'd like to present three suggestions. One suggestion is that too many of us are in the world and of the world. Howard Butt spoke about this last night, and I think that this is enough to say upon that issue. I would also add this, that to be in the world, you must know what the world is all about. And as Charles Malik, president of the United Nations, the 13th session, said, one of the responsibilities of Christians is they must first study and know the facts as profoundly as possible. This means thousands of hours of hard, responsible work, and this includes especially knowledge of the laws of change. The Christian has no excuse whatsoever to be shallow and sentimental. The Christian thinker must be the deepest thinker in the world. His aim is to overcome all stupid superficiality of analysis. And once we really understand the world, we'll discover why some people are in the world and of the world. It is not only because they conform, tempted by Satan, but it's because they've lost all meaning and they must have some sort of social approval. They must have some sort of identity, and so we could be charitable in some ways sometimes. That much of this mass of conformity and being in the world and of the world is because of the magnitude and the complexity of the world which faces us. But a second picture, it seems to me, would be one who is out of the world and not enough in the world. This would be one who is holy but not enough worldly. I have in mind the monk of the early days of the church who went out into the desert to try and establish a Christian style of life because he couldn't in the problems of the world. I have in mind also John Bunyan, who in the 17th century wrote The Pilgrim's Progress, which is the story of a man who stands with a Bible and tries to walk through all the temptations of the world, hoping that none of them will possess him until he can get to the safe journey beyond. John Bunyan himself, in the 60 books and tracts which he has written, all about the Christian and the pilgrim's progress in this world, there's not one single thing you can discover about the 17th century in which he lived by reading these things. Because, and this 17th century was one of the most tumultuous times of all Britain. This is when there was a change, really, to the constitutional form that there is now. This is the cradle of our own democracy as people were leaving the religious and political pressures there to come over to our own country. And all this fantastic movement of the world, not one idea of what's going on in reading his works, because there's a picture of someone completely separate, completely outside the world. And I think that this is an impossible picture for us today, but yet sometimes we are really in the world, or rather we are out of the world and don't realize it by living in the world. And I give you just these suggestions. By concentrating too much on just certain moral pieties, that I'm going to be very careful about particular prohibitions that come in my life. I'm going to be careful about drinking, about moral purity, about restoring my home life. And it's all seen in a completely individualistic basis, not realizing that really, although we're trying to escape the world inwardly, the world has invaded us. Because if we look around ourselves at our churches, we have no alcoholics, or we have no people of a different economic class. If we look around our churches, we have no people who have a different color beside us. And so the standards and values of the world have also come in upon us. And I can understand that there's a select group of a particular economic class here because of leadership basis.
But sometimes when we look around and discover there's perhaps, or I haven't seen a single Negro here, we sometimes wonder if perhaps the world has not also invaded us here. Are there not men of this color, of this caste, of this culture, who are also leaders, Christian leaders in their own community? And so there is a sense of escaping the world by concentrating on certain pietistic small elements that we can do and thinking that actually we're living out our Christian life. And this brings me to the third picture and the final picture of what it seems to me really means to be a Christian worldly holiness in the 20th century. It's a picture of a man by the name of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Bonhoeffer was a very eminent, brilliant German. He lived in an academic world. He was a pacifist. He lived away in the abstract. And suddenly he got caught in the rise of the Hitler movement and he began to come down to earth. He soon became not a pacifist, but one who was really struggling against the terror of Germany. He was put in prison because he actually came to the position where he thought he should plot on Hitler's life. The assassination failed. And the day after the assassination failed and he knew it meant his own death, this is what Bonhoeffer wrote from prison. During the last year or so, I have come to appreciate the worldliness of Christianity as never before. The Christian is not a homo religiosus, but a man, pure and simple, just as Jesus was man. Compared with John the Baptist, anyhow. I don't mean the shallow this worldliness of the enlightened, of the busy, the comfortable, of the lascivious. It's something much more profound than that. Something in which the knowledge of death and resurrection is ever present. I believe Luther lived a this worldly life in this sense. It is only by living completely in this world that one learns to believe. One must abandon every attempt to make something of oneself, whether it be a saint, a converted sinner, a churchman, a righteous man, or an unrighteous one, a sick man, or a healthy one. This is what I mean by worldliness. Taking life in one's stride with all its duties and problems, its successes and failures, its experiences and helplessness. It is in such a life that we throw ourselves utterly in the arms of God. And participate in his sufferings in the world and watch with Christ in Gethsemane. That is faith. That is repentance. And that makes a man and a Christian. How can success make us arrogant or failure lead us astray when we participate in the sufferings of God by living in this world? Perhaps instead of worldly holiness, a lay imperative, and with these words I close, it is rather responsibly free. This is the 20th century expression of the characteristic of the layman. We're responsible not to succeed or to fail. We're responsible to get involved, to be obedient to God and Jesus Christ, regardless of success or failure. And one of the things that's so marvelous to know is that in the Christian faith, we are not alone, but we're corporately together responsible. And also that this charting of a path in the changing planet is not a new one, because he has already come. He's already come into the world, died in the world, been raised in the world. And actually, at these frontiers of men's tensions and change, that is where Jesus Christ is working. And our task is to be there with him, obedient, responsible, his hands, his feet, at these places. No one, perhaps much like the layman, can actually be in the world where he has sent us. And this story. When I was a boy, I remember my mother saying that she would like for me to be a preacher because she thought this was the highest calling of all. I would like to suggest that, although I'm not going to be one of the changes in the understanding of the church today is I'm not sure that a preacher is the highest calling of all. I would put forth, perhaps, though I accept that in the Christian faith no calling is above another calling, but at least in our times, perhaps, it changes the picture or balances it, to say that maybe the highest calling of all, and I thought it was profoundly said last night, is that of a politician. Because he stands with the responsibilities of men before him. And this is a completely different picture than we've had. The politician can't be a Christian. Perhaps it is this kind of man that is really the 20th century type of Christian. In the midst of perplexities and problems, he identifies and participates in the sufferings of the world, knowing that when he tries to do good, some evil will come of it, knowing that even in himself there is evil. But he is free, freely forgiven of Jesus Christ, free to participate, free to know that this world is in someone else's hands and the transformation of the world depends upon God and not himself. Not but about a year ago in Washington, D.C., there stood a crowd of all the world's great figures in Arlington Seminary. It was the burial of John Foster Dulles. There were Russians, there were French, there were British. And there's this great statesman, regardless of what might say, because he accepted responsibilities in an office perhaps that has the most hated connotations to it.
There as he was laid in the ground, over in this crowd was one man, leaning on his wife and leaning on two little crutches. And nobody was noticing this man because they were paying attention to Dulles, or rather they were paying homage to him. But the man was Christian Herder. And there as the body went into the grave, the weight of the world's responsibilities descended upon this frail, crippled man. Perhaps it is symbolic of our time that his name is Christian.